I agree with my colleague, but I will offer an alternative idea that goes to an evolutionary psychology perspective, but is also present in animals and even other organisms, and that is the need for self-preservation. The fact that every species on the planet seeks to preserve itself is a moral statement. That my life matters because I want to continue to exist. And that's not even necessarily human dependent. I think the idea of fairness, if I was to offer a critique of fairness, would lie in the fact that, okay, that is true that a child can learn that through observation versus a transmission of this is what fairness is. But they can only observe that when that is something that is observable. Whereas the preservation of one's very life is intrinsic to them, intrinsic to the animal. For whatever reason, there is a desire to live. So I think...
What you're pointing out, though, I think is evidence for, or evidence against morality at all, because I'll tell you what I mean. If what we call morality is nothing more than evolutionary-driven behavior for self-preservation or for preservation of the species, then why are we calling it morality at all? It's simply evolutionary behavior. So I'll give you another example would be, besides fairness, another example would be, imagine that you or any average person was walking down a path by a stream, and right in front of you, a small child fell into the stream. I suggest that it would be an automatic reaction for probably a vast majority of people, without thinking about it, to reach down and pull the child to safety. To call that morality or a moral fact, which some people do, some people use that example as evidence for moral facts. But I would say that that's not morality at all. That's simply evolutionary behavior. It's driven by evolution, self-preservation or preservation of one's species. So to the extent that behavior promoting fairness or behavior promoting the welfare of other living things, to the extent that those things are driven by evolution, then they're evolutionary behavior. They're not morality at all. So where does morality come in? It's almost as though there's a contradiction between internal contradiction between morality and facts. If something's a fact, then it must not be morality driving it. It must be evolution driving it.
I think there's a bit of a problem with... First of all, I would like to say I agree with Tegan's proposition that the need or desire for self-preservation can be a universalizable principle. But I would say the problem with that is that it doesn't necessarily encompass all the factors of human experience, because it's one thing to say you want to preserve yourself. It's another thing to say you want to preserve your family or your society or your group. And you could say it's yet another thing to say, I want to preserve the short-term, you know, happiness or welfare or prosperity of my group or myself, or the long-term prosperity of myself. And then, of course, there are a whole bunch of contexts you can put onto short-term or long-term. So with that in mind, sure, we have a principle. And I think that you could tie fairness into that, where fairness is saying, like, well, okay, well, which one of these things is the most important? Is it, you know, the short-term benefit or the long-term benefit? And I think Michael's point is almost perfect. It almost reaches the ideal of, okay, well then why do we need morality? And I would push back on it by saying, hold on a moment. there are different contexts for morality, and we can't just say, like, okay, well, you know, human beings, just because they preserve themselves individually, or they preserve themselves collectively, now we have essentially no need for morality. Like, why do they preserve themselves collectively, but not, and preserve themselves individually? Like, those two things are not equivalent. So saving a child isn't the same as, you know, acting in your own sense of self-preservation.
And here again, I want to make that distinction between normative and meta-ethical theories, because we've delved up into the realm of how we should act in a particular scenario. But the question is, so a normative question is, how should we act, and what's the obligation for acting that way? So I think that's at the heart of this particular debate, is the question not only why should we, or, you know, should we pull the child out of the river or not? But the other question is, where's the obligation? Why are we obligated to act that way? Because morality, the other part of it, is that we should have to act rightly, correctly, goodly, if we're going to use, you know, traditional adjectives there, or adverbs. So the idea is, why, what is the obligation? And so, again, to Michael's proposition, maybe he's suggesting that if that obligation is nothing more than something in our genetics telling us preserve other human beings, then maybe there's no morality there. It's just something inborn in us that we can choose to ignore or accept. But more broadly than that, I want to ask whether or not, so again, the distinction between meta-ethics and normative ethics comes here. Even if we say that, whether or not we say that those things is something we should do or something we shouldn't do, the question is, what are those moral claims? Are they, for example, there could be a situation in which we have normative moral claims, things that we should do, and it's all subjective. It's all about our feelings. So, for example, if we feel poorly about seeing a child die when we have the opportunity to save them, that could be a claim about metaethical morality, that, you know, it's a moral thing that we should want to save that child, but it's just because we feel it would feel good to us. It would be pleasurable to us to save that child rather than leave it to drown. And that could go to Michael's point about evolutionary, you know, about evolutionarianism. On the other hand, if you're going to make a claim that there is something that tells us outside of us that we have to save that child, then you're asking yourself, is there a realist claim there? Now, I do want to turn the discussion to one other point that I wanted to make sure I drop in here before the end of the show, which is something called the standard view of psychology that I think could tell us a little bit about how we feel about these issues or what we think about these issues. And this is, again, something popularized by Hume, though he wasn't the first to suggest it, which is the idea that there's a distinction between two elements, facts and values. So facts, they're distinct entities, and there's no relation between them. So facts are subject to rational critique. It's a description of how the world is, right? It's descriptive. So if you say that 2 plus 2 is 5, you are making a rational, logical error about the way the world is. Values, on the other hand, are essentially reducible to desire. They are how the world should be. But they have no bearing on any real facts about the world. So if you tell me, I think that the people should be kinder, you're not telling me anything about the world that we currently live in, what people are like. You're just expressing a desire that people act in a different way. And so the idea here is that for realists, I'm going to throw a wrench to the realists that are in our call right now. For realists, the thing is, we seem to want moral facts that also influence our behavior. And the problem is, if you agree that there are facts and values, that's impossible. Because facts can't influence our behavior. They're just descriptions about how the world is. They describe nothing except what is currently there, not how we should change it. And then if morals are values, meaning they should influence our behavior because they're desires to change the world in a certain way, then they're no longer facts. So somehow realists have to make the claim that there are facts, moral facts, that are somehow special facts that are able to also influence our behavior. And this is a common sticking point in the discussion about psychology and morality, because the problem is that if you agree with this view that seems to be quite popular and quite common, that there are facts and there are values, or things that are and things that ought to be, morality can't be both. So I want to see what our realists have to say about that.
Well, I'm glad you asked, because I fundamentally disagree with your proposition.
Okay.
That there's a clear distinction between, that there is a clear distinction between facts and values, because I would say the facts in themselves are values, right? If we agree that, let's say for the sake of discussion, if we agree that all human life matters, that's a fact that also filters into a value system, right? There's no differentiation there. If all human life matters, that impacts how we act. But there's not a distinction in the fact. A, I don't see a problem there, really. B, I would say my definition of morality would be that morality is the deeper exploration of human behavior, that it is the abstraction of human behavior that somewhat addresses both problems we posited. There does not need to be this differentiation between facts and values. I would say more accurately, there's a distinction between fact and perception, because it can be a fact, let's say it can be a fact that all life matters, but how we perceive that and interpret that could be different based upon experience.
To respond to this, I think we have two options. I think we have more than two. We can put everything in the facts category, which is what it seems what the realists are trying to do. They're trying to say that in some sense, everything is factual or can be stated in a factual manner that is objectively true in some sense. On the other side of things, you can say, well, you know, everything is subjective. Everything is relative to context and situation. And so nothing is objective. Nothing is objective in any sense. And then you could kind of say there's a middle ground where, you know, we have some things that we agree upon, that everyone should agree upon, and we socially enforce this. And then we have, which is, I guess, and this is almost like the relativist view, but I'll say it anyway, from a sociological perspective, of we have a set of facts that we force everyone to agree with to be in our society. And if they don't agree with it, we don't acknowledge them as members of our society. And then we have values, which are things that we allow people to disagree and still be members in our society. So that's maybe not a helpful distinction, but some different ways of evaluating the problem. I think as a realist, ideally what we want is we want everything to belong to the facts category in some sense. We want everyone to be able to agree what problems are and how we can address those problems, even if we don't always agree that the solution for one problem should always be the same for all people. I think we can kind of create sets of solutions and sets of diagrams, and so we can allow various areas of ambiguity, but I think everyone wants some amount of coherence and correspondence in their categories.
Interesting. So I'm gonna parse this out a little bit, because I think there's some overlap going on that I think is unhelpful in the discussion, or that at least is confusing the positions a little bit. Because once again, I'm going to remind you that a realist, so a moral realist, doesn't have to be a realist about everything. So if you say that moral facts are facts about the world or the universe, you don't have to agree that everything is a fact about the universe in the sense that all answers to all questions are somehow facts embedded in the world around us. So I'll make that distinction, first of all. Second of all, once again, to be a realist, you don't have to agree that everything is factual, or that everything is embedded in a fact in the universe, some things can be subjective and you can still be a realist. As long as there is at least something, some non-zero amount of things that you think are factual about the world. So with that in mind, I think what's happening for both of you, Aaron and Tegan, is you see situations in which there seems to be things that are undeniable about what we think of morality. There seems to be some ways in which agreement is almost unanimous amongst human individuals that answers to certain questions are indisputable, and there are answers to certain questions that are indisputable. So in that sense, in order to solidify that realist position, you have to be able to explain to someone like me or Michael who disagree with you why, or rather, what those facts are, or how to describe them in a sense. So let me offer you a position that might help you. So while we've been taking down your idea that, you know, there are some kind of moral facts in the world on the basis of whether it's the standard view of psychology or whatever else, a similar author takes your position. Michael Smith is his name, and he writes that he also rejects the standard view of psychology. And he gives this instead. He gives this idea of the idealized self, which I think you're both kind of hinting at in your replies, that we may not be motivated by facts right now, but there exists an ideal version of ourselves that would do X thing in Y circumstance based on the facts. So for example, if you see an ad for something like famine relief, and you think, oh, I don't know, I'm lazy, I'm tired, I don't want to go up and get my wallet, or I don't know, money's tight this week, I don't know if I can really offer anything. So in that sense, right now you're not motivated by the fact that there are people out there that could use your money to feed themselves. That's a fact about the world. But in an ideal circumstance, the ideal you would say, yeah, I'm going to get up and I'm going to get my credit card and I'm going to pay, or I'm going to call these people and offer them my money because that is the right thing to do. Even if you're not going to do that thing right now. So, and you have reason to want to be like your ideal self. And so in that sense, you can be motivated by facts, because the facts tell you what the situation is like, and there is an ideal answer, a real answer, that you would give to famine relief, or you should give to famine relief. You must, if you are acting in an ideal moral way, which is an interesting thing that I think you were both hinting at that might help you to solidify your positions. Of course, I could go ahead and take that down as well, or I could try to, but I want to pass it back to Michael here, because he hasn't jumped in a while.
If there are indeed moral facts, or even one moral fact, how can there be an is-ought distinction? If a fact is a fact indeed, how can it ever be otherwise? How could anyone act contrary to a fact? Nothing else that's factual in the world has contrary behavior or scenarios. Like a rock always behaves like a rock. Objects in gravitational relationship to each other always act in predictable ways. There aren't exceptions. It's not like, you know, the Earth could say, well, you know, today I'm going to take 2 days to orbit around the sun. Or 2 years to orbit around the sun, or 2 days to orbit on my own axis. The facts of physics are always in operation without exception. Now, having said that, of course, Hume pointed out that, well, that doesn't mean that tomorrow the facts of physics will be the same as they are today. But for now, as best as we understand it, there are no exceptions. So if morality indeed entails facts, how come there's so much deviation? How can people... If indeed reaching down to reach a small girl who's drowning is a moral fact, how could there ever be an example of someone who does not do so? And yet sometimes people don't do so for all kinds of reasons. So I think moral facts run into trouble with their non-universalizability, with their non-uniformity, and with all the exceptions. Because of the is-ought distinction, because we recognize that people don't always act morally, in fact, they often do not, and there's a gap between what people ought to do and what people in fact do, I think that gap is a refutation of moral facts, because if morality was a fact, there shouldn't be such a gap between what should be and what is. If what should be is a fact, then there shouldn't be a distinction between what should be and what is.
Mikey, you clarified there that is ought distinction is basically another way of framing the standard view of psychology, fact and value, right? Is and ought. And so that's exactly the case. If you're going to uphold that view, that seems to take down the realist proposition quite well. Like I said, there are people that reject the is ought distinction, and there are, you know, ways in which they argue this, but thank you for offering that clarification.
So, Mihai, I have one final question for you. And it's not even a refutation of your argument. But seeing as you wanted to dive into our personal opinions of where we stood, or in my wheelchair-bearing self, where I sat on the issue, my question is, why do you align with relativism? What is the story that brought you to that decision? Have you always identified that way, or was there a particular argument or theory that kind of swayed you that way?
Well, thank you very much, Tegan, for the question. My thoughts on the matter sit somewhere like this. So realism makes the claim that there are moral facts that are universal, that are timeless, and that are objective. Yes, it doesn't matter where you are in history. It doesn't matter who you are, if you're an alien or a dog or a fire hydrant. There are moral facts about the world. And if people are going to act, they should act according to those facts. If you're a subjectivist, there are a few ways of going about it. But for the most part, you're trying to tell me as a subjectivist that there are no such facts. And that we, for the most part, that language serves two purposes, right? One is to talk about facts and to give each other information. But the other use is to motivate each other to do things. When you say, go do this thing, you're not describing a fact. You're saying simply that you want to motivate someone to go do this thing. However, I'm convinced by the argument that if you're going to be a subjectivist, it makes moral debate irrelevant. Because, for example, if I am a fan of capital punishment and my friend or my neighbor is not, us going into a debate about capital punishment really is just reducible to me saying, hooray, capital punishment, and my neighbor saying, boo, capital punishment is bad. But it doesn't actually reflect anything real. It's just our feelings about it. So why would it matter if we'd have this debate? I think relativism has a unique way of dealing with both of those issues. Because once again, it makes the claim that, so it does claim objectivity in the sense that when we are dealing with each circumstance, there is a right answer. However, it denies universality and timelessness or timeliness. It could go kind of either way, but here's how I see it. We in human history have had many diverse and distinct cultures and ways of being, societies formed differently. And in each of those scenarios, we act differently. Today, we look at the Aztecs, for example, who in the first millennium sacrificed their children to the sun gods, blood for the blood gods, so that the sun would rise the next day. And we think that behavior is barbaric and disgusting, and we wouldn't want people to do that in our society. And that's based on, their interpretations of the world versus our interpretations of the world. However, in their circumstance, in their place in history and with the knowledge that they had, this seemed like the best way to go about living their lives and achieving their best lives. Because imagine, if the sun didn't rise the next day, the earth, everything would your crops would disappear, everything would go wrong, and you can't have a flourishing society in that. And even if the belief was wrong, their historical circumstance dictated in a way what would be the morally right answer. They say that the right thing to do would be to sacrifice those children. And in that sense, like language, these moral descriptions or discussions evolve over time. And they change, and the rules change. But in the moment that we are talking to each other, or in the circumstance where we find ourselves, those rules will hold. So even if today we spell honor in America with no you, and in Britain, you know, now even today, but let's say a certain amount of years ago, they always spelled it with a U. That rule can change, but if you spell it any other way, you'd be wrong, because the fact stands now, even if it evolves over time. And so that ability to make morality a function of developing our best guides for how to live our lives in the context in which we are living, and have those rules change over time, but have the consistency of following the rules. So that ability to have moral guidance, guidance for our actions that evolves over time such that it is relative to our particular circumstance and allows us to flourish in our own circumstances in the best way, but allow the room for evolution such that those rules can adapt to allow us to flourish, and at the same time offer the consistency of a set of rules to follow in any given circumstance, that's what I think attracted me to relativism the most, because I see the best, how we should act should be a function of obeying rules that currently exist that are flexible enough to allow us, just like you would scrap an outdated law that was created just to belittle or to harm or to extort a certain group of people, you would retire things that claim to be moral guidance that no longer actually guide us in a proper way for our circumstances, our communities. And so that's, I think, to answer your question, Tegan, what attracted me to relativism. But I'll leave it to our audience to decide for themselves. So I just want to say a big thank you to Aaron Wang, Michael Robert Kaditz, and Tegan Marshall for joining me on this very riveting discussion on meta-ethical theories.
You can find archived recordings of The Canadian Philosophy Show on mixcloud.com/TheCanadianPhilosophyShow and tcps.podbean.com.
This is Free Voices at CJSF 90.1 FM, talking to you about
Eagle Nation Universal Production Society. We are 10 board of directors and we are rejoicing for world history. Our show is based on true stories, musical and storytelling and role playing, silent crimes broken, very interesting series of show.
And a lot of in-depth oral tradition. We play every Thursday from 3 to 4. Come and join us.
Starting from the week of Monday, May 30th, the Student Union Building is open 7 days a week from 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. The sub-building common spaces, along with the bookable spaces, are available for use. Any comments or questions, please go to the Simon Fraser Student Society website at sfss.ca for more information.
Best quality sound.
As I walk on, as I walk alone, I, as I walk alone, as I walk
You are now listening to